Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 57 of season 11 of Movie Our Minute, the daily podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Simon Appleton of the Movie Mustache. Welcome back to the show, Simon.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be back.
Yes, yes. I always like having you on, especially when we deal with battle-related episodes.
Yeah, it's definitely becoming a pattern.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, I'm pretty sure I gave you this one randomly. I don't think you didn't ask for this one, did you? Or maybe you did.
I think I did.
You asked for it. Okay, there you go.
Yeah, there's a specific reason, which I'm no doubt we'll get into shortly. But okay. Yeah, there was a reason why I asked.
All right, I'm looking forward to hearing that. Maybe it's because you're a Pole pretending to be part of the SS, or vice versa. I don't know. We'll see over the next few days how that works. All right, so let's start off with my initial question, Simon. What is your background with Band of Brothers?
Well, in terms of Band of Brothers, I first saw it when it broadcast on TV back in the day. Yes, I am that old. And I remember it being a big hit, as Saving Private Ryan was. It was done very much in the same vein. And I enjoyed Saving Private Ryan, as you're probably aware. And yes, so I was excited to see this and thoroughly enjoyed every minute of it. And I think I've owned it on DVD and Blu-ray.
Oh, wow. Excellent. Okay. And have you, is it something that you watch often? How many times do you think you've seen it over the 25 years since it came out?
I've probably seen it easily between 5 and 10 times, I'd say, possibly more.
Okay.
The most memorable time was I was watching it in a small French house that I was renting in Normandy.
Oh, wow. And did you take little breaks to go outside and look at the countryside and see, you know, if you can find Easy Company artifacts? I don't know.
Didn't find any Easy Company artifacts, but we visited all the beaches and the landing zones and all the famous sites. And we were watching it a couple of episodes at a time as the week went on that we were there.
Oh, wow. That is really cool. That's very cool. All right. So episode 57 begins with the men trying to find a way to treat Allie and ends with Winters and the men starting to shoot at the Germans. So we left things off yesterday with, I mean, this is a very unique part of, you know, the part five, the way that they're showing it, how it's, the story is basically being told in flashback, and you know, it's as Winters is putting in his report of what happened, you know, and it keeps jumping back. Yeah. We'll talk about this over the next few days and probably later into next week also with my other guests. You know, the way that it jumps back and forth by telling us the story of what's going on. And I, you know, that's one of the things that I've always loved about Band of Brothers is that each of the 10 parts give unique perspectives to things. You know, it's not something that, you know, they don't use the same template for each of them. They change the filmmaking style on every one of them. I really like the way that they do that, you know, to, on the one hand, to give us more of a reason, you know, to look at the uniqueness of each of the episodes, but also, you know, the perspective of each of the parts is generally from a different character's viewpoint, stuff like that. So
yeah, I think it puts a more human spin on it because it's easy, especially with a story as old as this. I mean, a lot of us don't know these people, but it makes them more than just characters in a story in a TV show. It makes the way Winters is recollecting it makes it even more relatable because we've all had to do something at that point, even if it's just recollecting to your partner, your family, your friends, something interesting that has happened to you at some point. We've all had to look back and think, and as he's typing it up, and it the way it sort of he's revisiting it, and it's all flowing, the emotions and everything of it is flowing over him, and Lewis gives a very authentic performance that way.
That's true. I mean, Damian Lewis is great in this miniseries. I mean, I think I mean, I've always liked him as as an actor with a lot of the other things that he's done, but I still think even though he was superb in Homeland, I still think this is a better performance because it
Yes.
you know, it gives us a more tangible look at who Dick Winters you know, I guess you could say supposedly was. But based on all of the references that we've heard, you know, from people who knew Dick Winters, you know, he gives a spot on per a spot on I wouldn't say imitation, but he's a spot on portrayal of
Yes.
Winters with that type of thing.
Who the man was.
Yeah, exactly. And again, we're gonna see that over the next few days. You know, the leadership qualities that Winters imbued throughout his career, but also specifically, you know, in the Crossroads episode where we're going to see it.
Yes.
So, you know, right at the beginning of the this 5-minute segment, so, you know, they had just brought Allie into the, you know, into the staging area where everyone was inside, and you know, they put him on the table, and you know, they're somewhat arguing as to how they're supposed to be taking care of him, and you know, one of the guys screams out, "Hey, you know what, Joe? Back off!" And then Winters takes control and he goes, "Lisniewski, send a runner for Lieutenant Welsh." And then he turns to Lipton and goes, "Lipton, assemble me a squad." And Lipton goes, "Yes, sir. First squad on your feet. Weapons and ammo only. Let's go. Let's go." And you know, we can see that there's a lot of hustle and bustle of everything that's going on. And you know, Doc Rowe shows up, and you know, you know, people are only going to hear this at the end of the month, but I had a I had an interview with the writer of episode 6, Bruce McKenna, and you know, one of the things that he told me is that, you know, in the book, Doc Rowe is not mentioned that often. You know, he's mentioned maybe like 3 times, and there's also another interview that I did later that people will hear in a month and a half from now was with Doc Rowe's grandson. You know, the fact that Doc Rowe is not really mentioned in the book, but in order to make the character more well known, because part 6 is going to be focusing on him. So Bruce McKenna said that he spoke to the writers of previous of the episodes beforehand and said, "Okay, you need a medic here. Why don't you use Doc Rowe? This way, people will be able to, you know, recognize Shane Taylor, and they're going to know that, you know, when we get to part 6 and we have this character Doc Rowe that we're focusing on, everyone's going to already know who he is because he's, you know, he's been in a lot. He's popped up along the way. So I really like the way they do that. You know, it's
Yeah.
a, I guess it's a little bit of literary license to do that, but still, it works."
Definitely. I mean, obviously they would have called a medic in. I like the fact that even though a lot of these guys, they've been in this since D-Day, they've got experience, but there's still the element of that's my friend just been blown up with a grenade laying on a table. And there's panic, there's fear, there's people trying to do stuff, there's other people trying to do other stuff. And Winters has to come in and be the leader that he is. Lipton does the same thing, which is something that I think made the video diary that they tagged in, that Ron Livingston made, that they tagged in with the
Yes.
DVD, all the more amusing, because you see the actor playing soldier in the video diary, and then you see the character, the person in the show, and you get the contrast, and it's just quite amusing to see the difference between real person he's playing. But you get that staunch leadership. There's no hesitation. Winters is dishing it all out. You do this, you do this, you do this. He's coordinating everything. Lipton instantly knows what to do. He's on it. He deals with his job. And then Doc comes in, gives the guys a couple of sparky bits, but then it's I'm medic. He goes into medic mode and he's talking to Ali and he's doing his checks and going through the system, and there's that calm, warm, gentle tone comes out, and I think I mean, speaking personally, I particularly like the character of Doc Rowe, and I thought it was brilliant picking him for episode 6 to be the focal point, because there's a futility there because obviously of his differing role. But here, I like that he comes in and he's just a wave of calm, and I've seen that with paramedics, and they just come in tense situation. Hello, you're right, love. I was actually at a road traffic collision not so long ago, and that's exactly what they did. They exactly like doctors. They come in, and it's just, hi, how's everyone doing? You okay? What's going on? Hello, how are you? Talking to the patient, and the actor really nailed that in that scene, and I really like that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I have a friend who, I guess it was about 2 months ago, he was hanging something, and he dropped off, and he fell off the ladder, and banged himself up. He didn't break anything or anything else. But what he said was is that when the paramedics came, you know, the thing that soothed him the most is one of the paramedics held his hand while the others were checking him, you know, telling him, okay, don't worry, you know, you're gonna be okay. We're gonna be dealing with you, you know, and stuff like that. So it definitely fits in really well with what you just said, you know.
Yeah.
That's the way that they, you know, that the first thing you need to do is make sure that you're, you know, that the patient is as calm as possible.
You know, yeah, that's, definitely.
So that's really important. And then Doc Rowe starts, you know, giving orders. He goes, get the boots off and elevate the leg. Leave that. Use the sulfur. All right, let's get this done quickly. We got to move. Not too much. And then, as you said, he turns to Allie and he goes, hey, Allie. All right. You know, in a calm voice, the way that he says it to him. And then the shot changes and we're back to Winters, you know, typing up the report about what happened. And what came to mind when I was watching this is the fact that, you know, anyone who knows anything about Tom Hanks knows that Tom Hanks is a big fan of typewriters. And it made me wonder if they decided to do this in order to, you know, either it was Hanks's, maybe it was his idea to do it this way, or someone was just saying, okay, let's placate to Tom Hanks and let's put in a typewriter here.
Yeah. I never thought about that. As soon as you started talking, I know where he's going with this. It never occurred to me, but yeah, I do wonder that. That's an interesting question. I can imagine it being half a dozen of one, you know, six of the other.
Yes, 100%. No, we'll never know the truth about that, because even if you know, I ever do get a chance to speak to the writer of this, he's not going to tell me, yeah, I did that because of Tom Hanks. So
yeah,
but no, of course not. Why would I do that because of Tom Hanks? You know. So, but I mean, when we dealt with Saving Private Ryan, so we found, I think, like three instances that we're dealing with typewriters, and it was like, okay,
Lion, yeah. I wonder who this was for.
You know,
probably half of them were his.
It's very possible, and I remember joking about the fact that if they weren't his, then he said, okay, I'm going to take these at the end of filming. You know,
yeah, that'd be the thing I steal from set.
I need this for my collection. Or vice versa. Let's look at it from a positive spin. They decided to give it to him, you know, at the end of, you know, here, we're just going to get rid of it anyway, and we know that you have use for it. So, you know, here's a present from everyone on staff, you know.
I mean, I've seen him come on a British talk show and bring one with him, so I'm sure he wouldn't complain.
Probably not. probably not. You know, but that's Tom Hanks. I mean, everyone knows that Tom Hanks is the nice guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that it definitely makes sense with the way that they're going to be doing it. Now, what's interesting is you can see some of what Winters is typing, and he mentions the fact that that Allie was injured by a grenade. But we're going to have to wait until much later in this part to see what actually happened to Allie. But I like the fact that they do focus in on it just to give us a little bit of a teaser, I guess, to be able to hear what possibly Allie is, you know, what has happened to him along the way type of thing. You know, so I like that. And I also like the fact that they show him that he's, you know, two-finger typing.
Mm. Yes, you know, he's not a natural typist.
That's right, which shows that he's doing it because he needs to, not because he really likes to do it this way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the shot changes, and we see the men walking through a ditch, basically. And then they hear a whole bunch of shooting in the distance, and they all, you know, duck down. One of the guys goes, "What the hell are they shooting at? What's down the road?" And then the Winters answers and goes, "Regimental headquarters. But that's 3 miles away. Why are they giving away their position?" "Maybe they're not as smart as me and you." And then Winter goes, "Well, I'll check it out anyway." And he goes, "Hold there. Wait for my signal." And, you know, again, this is a yes, sir. And this is a perfect example of Winters, once again, showing that he is the perfect leader. You know, he's going to go check it out himself. He's not going to choose one of the guys to go check it out. You know, this is what I'm going to be doing. Mm. And then, you know, he just goes off on his own. And
he's not willing to send someone else to do something that he wouldn't do.
So. That's correct. That's correct.
Yeah.
And then the guy he's talking to says, "Holding here. I'm waiting for a signal." And then we see that Winter gets to the top of this this hill, and you know, moves over it stealthily, and we hear a lot more shooting in the distance, stuff like that. And you know, he's trying to get a view of what's going on, and he's not really sure. I mean, it's you know, first of all, the way that they shoot this is great, because it shows us what's going on, you know, from Winter's perspective. And
yeah, we see Winter, as much as he does.
That's right. And Winters has left everyone behind. You know, he's the scout. Usually you don't send the company commander on a scouting mission, but as you said, Winters is the type of guy who will not send anyone to go do something he's not going to do himself. So, you know, if I'm there, I'm going to be the one to do it.
Yeah, I suppose it's a balance in a way, because there's that. There's the, well, I've got to be willing to do it as well. But also, this is such a confusing situation, because normally if you get someone, you know, if you get the enemy come through your lines, they're not in some desperate rush to give away their position. So for a bunch of Germans to be standing on a crossroads with an MG-42 blasting down a road with no discernible target, just making a lot of noise, it's weird. So if you send someone else to look at it, he can come back and he can describe it, but you'll never know properly exactly. He probably partly wants to see, "I've got to see this for myself. You know, I have to understand what the hell is going on here." So he goes and checks himself.
Right.
Before getting the men in there.
Okay, that's true. But again, you know, usually the company commander is not supposed to put himself in danger for this type of thing, because he's needed for other things down the line. You know,
absolutely.
You know, obviously, everyone is expendable, but some people are, you know, some people should be kept in reserve as much as possible before you're going to go send them in order to make sure that everything that's going on is safe. it's a safer. I mean, we're not going back to what we talked about. When they were in Carrington, where Colonel Strayer didn't want to walk into the street because he was scared that there would be shooting. But you know, it shows the differences between Winters and Strayer from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Because based on what I know and what I've seen of how Dale Dye portrays Colonel Sink, if it was Sink, he would still walk into the middle there. I think again, I can't guarantee that, but the way that he's portrayed makes it seem as if he would be also one to go in there, you know, and not take the and not worry about taking the risk, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah,
but we never get.
Yeah, he probably would have just if he'd have been in the Winters scenario, he probably would have just crouched down in the middle of the street, plucked the bit of shrapnel out of his leg, got up, and kept going.
Yes, that is definitely
that,
very
that kind of old soldier.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And you know, the Winters, runs back to the top of the hill and motions once again back to his men. I love the way that they keep showing us all these hand signals, even though we have no actual clue what each of these hand signals means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not. We've talked about it in the past. It's not something that's completely universal. You know, it's hand signals that you and your men have set up. You know, that type of thing. So that also makes things a little more difficult to know exactly what orders he's giving them. But the idea that we're supposed to take away from this is that he's still making sure that everyone's going to be following the orders that he wants taken care of at that particular moment in time.
Yeah.
You know, so they're still able to give us that. You know, we don't have to be concerned about that. And then the men get up and they start running up the hill towards Winters, and then we're back at Winters typing up his report. Takes a swig of water, a few shots of Tom Hanks's favorite pastime, and then we're back to the men who have now come to the other side of this hill, and you know, they're all crouched down to you know, not be seen, and then they all follow Winters and start setting up their positions in order to get ready for their assault and for the attack that they're going to be doing. And the Germans are still shooting, you know, and we're still not sure what they're shooting at.
Yeah.
And then Winters gives an order, and he goes, "This is our fallback position here." And he goes, "Mortars, deploy here. First squad on me. Second on the right." You know, so again, he's still giving orders to everyone how to set up and how to deal with things. You know, I mean, we know that Winters is a great tactician, even if it's not true that Bretoncourt Manor assault is something that he created himself. We know that even though the miniseries says that he created it, we know that he didn't, and they don't teach it in West Point. But but it's nice to think that. But we still know that he's a good tactician.
Yeah.
You know, he knows how to set things up, and you know, even if it's just following the orders or the plans that have already been set beforehand, he at least knows what he needs to do and how to do it. So that's always great to watch them do it. And then you have the guys with the mortars go to the side to set up, and the rest of them start running, following Winters, getting ready for this assault on this unknown group of enemies that they have no idea who's there and how many are there or anything like that. And then the shot changes once again, and we're back to Winters typing. and he pushes the lever on the typewriter, you know, to move to the next line. And then we see Winters back at the crossroads himself, looking and seeing that all these Germans are just standing there at this crossroads. You know, again, not 100% sure what they're doing and why they're there, would you see that they're shooting?
Rather odd that they were there shooting, trying to draw attention, and yet they don't really have a what I'd call a defensive posture in place.
Correct. And that's right. And then Winters turns around to the men that are down at the bottom of this part of the hill, and he signals them to come up. And the men start coming towards him. And then he says, okay, second on the right, first on the right, third on the right, nail the machine gun. Second on the left, first on the left. Wait for my signal. And,
no one needs to ask what the signal is.
That's right. He's getting ready for this whole thing. And then he goes, prepare to fire. And, the men are getting ready. We see everyone starting to aim their guns. And then they show the mortars. And we have Cobb there. And Cobb goes, prepare to fire. And then one of the guys goes, two rounds. Ain't she quick? And then we get a shot of Winters taking aim. And, this is really a waiting game here. And we can, feel the anticipation of the men as they're all ready, getting ready for this particular assault. They're able to take their time also, because nobody has broken the silence of the whole area. And then they just start shooting. Winters is the first one to start shooting at the Germans, and then the men start following suit. And as they're doing that, that's where this 5-minute segment ends. So I like the way that they show this, because it shows so much of the leadership qualities that we all know about from Dick Winters. Here he is on a mission, and he's able to quite easily lead these men to where they need to go, and on the spot make up the ideas of what needs to be, of how he's going to deal with this particular assault. I like that.
Yeah, it's interesting seeing how much more comfortable he is in a battlefield scenario than he is sat at a desk with a typewriter.
I think that's one of the things they're trying to show us here also.
Yeah.
And it is something that will come up many times through the course of the rest of this miniseries. Yes. About what is Dick Winters' job. We'll see it, I think, when they're in Foy and he wants to go and join in on the battle, and he's yelled at, I'm pretty sure by Sink, you stay here, this isn't where you're supposed to be. This is basically foreshadowing that by showing us, okay, this is what he's good at and this is what he knows how to do, but this is not what they want him for anymore.
Yeah. And again, it harkens back to the whole idea of, I'm not going to send men to do what I'm unwilling to do. He'd rather be in there doing it and with the men than stuck at the back watching or coordinating if possible.
Right. The ironic part about it is that usually when someone is in that type of situation, it's because they don't trust the men. He trusts the men, but he wants the men to also trust him. And the fact that you have a commander that will lead the way is a reason for you to trust them. That's the irony of the whole thing. And I like the way that they portray that for us. So we get to see who Dick Winters really is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So today's segment is called Band Brand, where my guests will give their top five movie or fictitious movie bands. So why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Right, here we go. Music's not my strong suit, so this was always going to be an interesting one. But number five, I've got Fat, Horny, Black, and Joe from Family Guy, the episode Don't Make Me Over, where Peter Griffin and his little band of reprobates sing karaoke in the bar one night. They sing Don't Stop Believing very badly, and then decide to form a band, and it goes horribly wrong because they're completely uncoordinated, and that always makes me giggle.
You are aware of the fact that that's not a movie, right?
I know, I cheated a bit. I cheated a bit. I've cheated twice, in fact, because I've got another show in here.
That's right.
But coming in at number four is it's a real band, but their frontman's definitely fictional in this because it's from the movie Eurotrips. Lustra. I don't know how you pronounce it. They sing that song Scotty Doesn't Know, about the lead singer spending some intimate time with his girlfriend. And apparently Scotty is not aware that the lead singer is spending some time with his girlfriend, hence the song. Number three, you got Faith Plus One, Cartman's Christian rock band from South Park, where they take songs already in circulation, and some quite famous ones too, and just change it to being about Jesus and all that. Okay, the top two are kind of linked because my favorite film, Back to the Future, is my favorite film of all time, and the finale at the dance is a great scene. So I do. Number two, you've got Marvin Berry and the Starlighters, their take on Earth Angel, great song, and they're brilliant. And then topping that is just Marty McFly and the Starlighters singing Johnny Be Good. That is my favorite version of that song. It's the first version of that song I ever heard, funnily enough, because I've loved Back to the Future since I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And we're almost the same age, that movie and I.
Wait, so the question is, how old were you when you first saw it and heard that? It came out in 85.
Certainly younger than five.
Yes. Oh, wow. Okay. See, I was 11 when it came out, so I'm a little more familiar with. I'd heard Johnny Be Good before, but never in that in that context. And obviously,
yeah.
You know, I it does have a soft spot for me too.
Hmm.
Until the end.
When I actually recently read Michael J. Fox's book on making Back to the Future and Family Ties at the same time, and he was speaking about that scene and how they changed the note just slightly to tweak it a bit, to bring it more in line with how an 80s band would play it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite interesting. It was a good, really good book. But yeah, that was quite interesting to read how they just tweaked it just slightly, just to change it to fit more of an 80s tone.
Oh, wow. Very interesting. Cool. All right. That is a great list. And now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie, where I will give you a little bit of clues and hints, and you have to try and guess the what World War II movie we are referring to.
Okay.
We'll see how your knowledge is of World War II movies. All right. So let us spin the wheel and see what we get. And around and around and around the wheel goes. Okay. This is a movie from 1989 that's all about the H-bomb. Do you have any idea what movie that might be?
1989 movie about the H-bomb. No, I don't think I do.
Okay, it stars Paul Newman. Does that help at all?
Kind of.
And it's named after the names of the two bombs. How does that help?
So,
I mean, it's all about the Manhattan Project and things like that.
Yeah, Oh, it's a sort of little boy and
What's the other one called? One of them is called Little Boy. But
yeah, little
Little
boy
Boy is the
and
second half of the title of this movie.
oh, Fat Man.
Very good.
Fat Man and Little Boy.
That's right. That is the name of this movie. Batman and Little Boy. Excellent. It's really funny thinking about it that you have Dwight Schultz playing Oppenheimer. Dwight Schultz is from the A-Team.
Yes. That's
Now that we've seen the Christopher Nolan version of Oppenheimer, so it's just funny looking at
very different take.
the very different take. Completely. So, yeah, that's great. All right. Would you like to tell everyone where they can find you?
You can find my site, The Movie Mustache at moviemustache.com. It's now officially 10 years old. Recently passed that milestone. You can also find me on the usual social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Threads, at movie underscore mustache, apart from Facebook, where I'm Movie Mustache 2.0 for crazy Facebook related reasons that I won't go into. But yeah, you can find me in all those places.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So, until tomorrow, Kareem!
Sure, hey.